The reading this evening is from Exodus 32. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a feast to the Lord." So the next day, the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them, and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, 'These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses. "They are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." But Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. "Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, 'I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever.'" Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God, engraved on the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There is the sound of war in the camp." Moses replied, "It is not the sound of victory. It is not the sound of defeat. It is the sound of singing that I hear." When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned, and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them into pieces at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf the people had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. He said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin?" "Do not be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him.' So I told them, 'Whoever has any gold, jewelry, take it off.' Then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Moses saw that the people were running wild, and that Aaron had led them in get out of control, and so became a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance of the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp, from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor. The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Then Moses said, You have been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers, and he has blessed you this day. The next day, Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. So Moses went back to the Lord and said, oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They have made themselves gods of gold, but now please forgive their sin. But if not, then blot me out of the book you have written. The Lord replied to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Now go, lead the people to the place I spoke of, and my angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin. And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron had made.
Well, how serious is sin? I'm told that as a church we talk a lot about sin, and that begs the question, are we right to do so? Are we making something out of nothing? Are we making mountains out of molehills? How serious is sin? If you were to ask around, I dare say lots of people would say, well, it's really not that big a deal. One newspaper said, in this day and age, sin has lost its sting. A bit of sinning is much more likely to be seen as a bit of grown-up naughtiness, something that sends a delightful tingle up the spine. A few years ago, Magnum Ice Cream released their range of ice creams called the Seven Deadly Sins, each flavour sinfully indulgent. One commentator says, we live in a time when six of the seven deadly sins are now medical conditions, and pride is seen as a virtue. Or, well, given that people don't believe in God, well, sin's sometimes brushed away as a victimless crime. I mean, who really gets hurt if you worship a statue? It's like speeding down the motorway at night. No one really gets hurt. No one really sees. It doesn't really matter. Others argue, well, sin is just as much God's fault as mine. If God made me this way, why is he so worked up that I would act this way? Others push it further and say, well, it's the very idea of sin that is sinful. One big power play to make people feel guilt and make people feel shame, and so the church can control them in some way. Perhaps the real sin is talking about sin. We come today to Exodus 32, one of the darkest passages, I think, in Israel's history, a passage that has deliberate echoes of Genesis 3 and Adam and Eve and the fall of man, and it's here to show us the seriousness of sin. 1 Corinthians 10, 6 and 7, we'll quote it by saying, these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Exodus 32 is here as a warning sign. Not pretty to look at, but absolutely necessary if it's going to keep us safe. How serious is sin? To answer the question, I first need to show you what sin does to God. Simply put, sin swaps God for something else. Psalm 106 would later reflect on Exodus 32, and it would say, at Horeb, they made a calf and worshipped an idol cast from metal. They exchanged the glorious God for an image of a bull which eats grass. That's deliberately pointed. It's not just saying that there was a swap going on. It's saying that there was a stupid swap going on. They exchanged the glorious God for a lump of metal, an image of something that spends most of its days just eating grass. Let's see how that happens then as we work our way through Exodus 32. And to make really rather an obvious point, Exodus 32, of course, comes after chapter 31, doesn't it? It comes after six detailed chapters for how God can rightly be worshipped. It comes after Israel has agreed to do all that the Lord has commanded them to do. Three times they say, yes, we're going to sign up to it. We're going to do it. It comes after God has given them the Ten Commandments. The first of which, you shall have no other gods before me. The second, you shall not make for yourselves any images in the form of anything in heaven above, or the earth below, or in the waters beneath. It comes after God's mighty hand and outstretched arm has rescued them from slavery to Pharaoh in Egypt and brought them to safety at the mountain. All of which set the scene for this betrayal. They're not turning their backs on just some minor acquaintance here. They're turning their backs on God just a few days after getting married to him. Chapter 32, verse 1 says, "When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, 'Come, let us make gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, who brought us out from Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him.'" It's worth noticing, isn't it, what it was that drove them to it. What drove them to it was a delay. Moses is late coming down the mountain, and they would want to get on with things. There's maybe a hint of fear here that if they stay here too long, their enemies are going to find them and try and wipe them out. But largely, it's just the delay. God's not moving to our timetable, and we want you to get on with it. Let's take matters into our own hands. Verse 2, Aaron answered them, "Take off your gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took them and handed him, and made them into an idol, cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." It's worth saying that nearly everything in these verses is stolen. The gold belonged to God's tabernacle. It was destined for worship of God. Ends up being used for worshipping a cow. The praise that belonged to God for the Exodus now is given to this cow. In verse 5, the sacrifices that had been offered to God earlier in chapter 24, when they're making this covenant, making this relationship with God, well, now it's given to a cow. It's like they're doing a marriage renewing their vows ceremony, but doing it with a different partner. Even God's name is now given to the statue. And in verse 6, the extraordinary privilege that they enjoyed in chapter 24 of eating and drinking with God is replaced with a grotesque parody and a drunken orgy. Verse 5, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there we will have a festival to the Lord." And so the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. After they sat down to eat and drink, they got up to indulge in revelry. Revelry there being a euphemism for sexual immorality. Now, some of us here will probably have grown up having known about the golden calf from a very early age, having done it in Sunday schools. And that's no bad thing. That's a great thing. But Sunday schools can sometimes just soften the edges of the story slightly, and we need to recapture that as we go through. So a while back, Lucy and I, my wife and I, celebrated our sixth wedding anniversary. I've known Lucy for nearly 9 years now, and one of the first things that I learned about my wife is that she doesn't like licorice and she doesn't like mushrooms. Now, you can imagine, can't you, the damage that would be done if we then got to our sixth wedding anniversary, and I decided this one meal out of the year where we really try and make an effort try and at least look smart and put an effort into all the food. If I decided on this meal, we're going to serve up portobello mushrooms covered in a licorice sauce, well, she would be right to be angry, wouldn't she? But that's exactly what it, well, not exactly what Israel have done, but that is what Israel have done. God has just spent chapter after chapter after chapter saying, this is what I like, this is what I love, this is what I don't like. But having received that list, well, Israel have gone, no, no, here's how we're going to love you. We're going to love you by doing the exact opposite of what you want. Sin isn't just breaking some arbitrary rule. It isn't a victimless crime. It's like spitting in the face of your partner. But even worse than that, if our anniversary rolled around again, and this time, instead of inviting Lucy to the wedding anniversary dinner, instead this time I thought, do you know what? It'll be fine if I just have a photo of Lucy there instead. She can go off and do her own thing. Again, she'd be right to be angry, wouldn't she? Yes, that's what Israel did. They'd reduce the living God, who they might have a living relationship with, to an image that could be pushed around, something that they could project their ideas onto. The problem with statues is that they never really tell the full story, do they? We felt the full force of that in 2020, as statues of put up to commemorate public figures were torn down for their links with the slave trade. The problem was that the statue had only told half of the story. A statue that glorifies one part of their life but had diminished the other. And that's what this statue does. The Israelites probably thought, well, we're flattering God by turning him into an image of a calf. I'm told that an image of a calf was a symbol of strength and of fertility back then. But that's only half the story. Calves aren't very intelligent. Calves can be led by the nose. Calves are easily angered by red flags being waved around. To reduce God to a calf, even a golden calf, is to give us the wrong impression about God and the wrong impression about our relationship to it. To reduce the living God to a lump of metal, no matter how well crafted, is an insulting lie. But it's even worse than that. If our anniversary came around again, and this time not even inviting Lucy, not even inviting a photo, heaven forbid that this should happen. But if this time I decided to celebrate that anniversary in a strip club, well, you kind of get an imagine, a glimpse of how insulting this is. Of course, the God they designed themselves would allow them to design their own morality to go with it. A God who smiles down on their own sexual immorality. But what makes this so grotesque, so awful, is that they think that this is actually going to please God. They haven't forgotten him. This is their grand gesture, their act of love towards him. Verse 5, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. Oh, that's a warning sign for us, isn't it? That it's entirely possible to worship idols while still claiming to love the Lord. Idols don't completely depose God. In our minds, they can sit quite nicely alongside him. But notice what their sins had done to God. After all of God's kindness, they'd swapped him for a statue and shrunk him down to something at their beck and call, something that can be led by the nose. It's not surprising, is it, that God's anger burns against them? It would be entirely wrong if it didn't. But we need to remember that this is here as a warning for us. These things occurred as an example to keep us from setting our hearts on evil as they did. Which begs the question, doesn't it? Do we think our sins are any different? Do we think our sins are any less insulting? When Jesus has told us how to love him, when like Israel we say, well, no, no, I'm not going to love you that way. I'm going to love you by doing the exact opposite of what you want. when Jesus tells us not to store up treasure for ourselves in this world, but our bank balances reflect significant investments here. And when Jesus tells us life doesn't consist of the abundance of your possessions, and yet our houses are chock full of clutter. When Jesus says that anyone who looks lustfully at another commits adultery, and yet our internet browsing history tells a different story. When Jesus tells us to take up our cross and follow him, but our sofa is just far more comfortable. When Jesus says, woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, but we value other people's opinion more than his. When we do these things, we aren't just breaking a rule, we're spoiling a relationship. Now, our idols are harder to spot, aren't they? We wouldn't be so brazen as to make a golden statue to them. They can be good things, can't they? Productivity, comfort, family, cash, all good things. But when we cling to them instead of God, well, it's no different to Israel. We exchange the glorious God for an image of a bull which eats grass, something which has to be held up and sustained by us. Well, that's what sin does to God. Secondly, though, we need to see what sin does to us. Sin does something to God, and it does something to us as well. It doesn't leave us alone. See, in Exodus 32, Israel become like the statue that they worship. A few times, Israel are described like cattle. In verse 8, they've been quick to turn away. In verse 9, they are stiff-necked. Verse 25, the people are running wild. In verse 26, they have to be corralled. They have to be penned in like cattle by Moses. In verse 34, they have to be led like an animal. The language portrays them as wild calves or untrained cows. Hosea 4 picks up on that idea, describing Israel as stubborn, like a stubborn heifer, like a calf needing a yoke. Worryingly, they become like the statue that they worship, like a statue of a cow, stubborn and stupid. One Christian author who I've been trying to read this last week, Greg Beale, helpfully points out, I think, we make gods in our image, but even as we do so, they remake us in their image. The golden calf enshrines the virtue of strength and fertility. And as they worship that, well, the echo comes back to them, only clothed as the voice of God. What would this golden calf tell them to do? Well, of course, it would encourage them to be strong and promiscuous. What we worship shapes us and conforms us into its likeness. Take, for example, the teenage girl that worships the celebrity singer. It's one thing, isn't it, to enjoy the music, but it doesn't stop there, does it? Given time, they'll take the CD into the bathroom and eventually try and look like them, try and act like them. That's why we no longer call them singers, we call them influencers as well. Or the person who worships football. Well, they end up dressing like a footballer and dressing their children like footballers, and worse, become consumed by competition and the quest for glory. Perhaps deeper than that. What about those who worship money? Well, they don't become green and crinkly, do they? We're not saying that. But they do tend to weigh the world according to a financial value. Time has a financial value. The people around them are weighed by how much they earn. Their self-esteem is linked to a figure in the bank. The person who worships sex ends up valuing others only really as potential mates and struggles to form deeper connections. This should make us very careful about what we worship. If we realize just what it's doing to us, then it had come with a very serious health warning printed on the side. Sin isn't a victimless crime, and in some ways, we're the first victim. We become enslaved to it. Just think about the person who worships alcohol, ends up enslaved by alcohol. The person who worships career ends up chained to a desk, and their personality becomes molded by the company they serve. Sin shrinks God, but it also shapes us. And the rest of the chapter outlines the even more serious consequences of our sin. Sin ruined the relationship between Israel and God. That's what's happening in verse 19. When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned and he threw the tablets out of his hand, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. The tablets of stone, well, they were to be the lasting reminder of the relationship between God and man, now lying broken at the foot of the mountain. That's the equivalent, isn't it, of getting the marriage certificate and tearing it up in front of a spouse, or taking off the wedding ring and throwing it into the sea. The relationship is broken. Not only that, but they've exposed themselves to God's wrath. In a sobering scene, Moses calls anyone who's on the Lord's side to himself, and a disappointing few respond, only really the sons of Levi. That means that 11 of the other tribes are either indifferent to what's happening or engaged in what's happening. Verse 27. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man, strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." It's a terrifying scene, isn't it? When it says brother, it perhaps doesn't mean biological brother, if all the tribe of Levi have responded to it. But even so, they are killing their fellow countrymen, which gives us a glimpse, again, of just how seriously God takes sin. This idolatry was like a malignant cancer that needed to be cut out straight away. Left unchecked, it would spread and destroy the whole camp. We do people no favors when we downplay sin and pretend it doesn't matter. This is a small foretaste of God's wrath, God's anger, which will be poured out on Judgment Day. Even after the swords decimated the camp, well, a plague swiftly follows on its heels, verse 35. And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron had made. Now, Israel are no better than Egypt, are they? Just as the plagues had come upon Egypt, well, Israel now sit under exactly the same judgment, and perhaps even more severe of all. If we just read on in chapter 33, verse 2, it says, I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way. Well, entering the promised land without God is like winning the battle but losing the war. It's a Pyrrhic victory at best, like winning the house in the divorce. To be quite frank, my house would be lose any of its value if I lost Lucy. She's the one thing that makes it fun, makes it a nice place to dwell and to enjoy. So it is with the promised land. It's robbed of any of its joy. If without God there is no blessing. And so to return to the question that we started with, how serious is sin? Well, sin is not some ice cream indulgence to be enjoyed. Sin is not liberating, but enslaving. Sin is deathly serious. And as I said at the beginning, this is here as a warning for us and as an example to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Which then raises the very personal question, what do you set your heart upon? It'd be unfair of me, wouldn't it, to ask you that question, without at least mentioning the plank that's in my own eye. Personally, in my life, I think my two greatest idols that I've battled with have been marriage and ministry. Two very good things which I turned into God. It made me desperate to be married, and it made me prickly or crushed when anything went wrong at work. And God has been very slowly, very patiently, trying to prise that idol out from my hand. But I'm sure that when they go, others will spring up in their place. The medieval theologian John Calvin says that our heart is just a factory of idols, a forge for idols. It just keeps churning them out, one after the other, after the other, after the other. What do you set your heart upon? What is your golden calf? Exodus 32 should be a sobering reminder of the seriousness of sin. But then we ask the question, is there any hope for sinners? How can we escape from God's burning hot wrath? Exodus 32 leaves Israel with little room for hope. No, they can't hide behind the covenant, can they? It's broken at the foot of the mountain. Would you really remind your spouse of their wedding vows when you've just broken yours? They can't hide behind Aaron. Somewhat limply, just like Adam had done, when Aaron's confronted with his sin, he throws the blame back onto them. It was them that made me do it. They can't hide behind the Levites, behind the priests who might atone for the sins, because they're the ones who are carrying the swords. They can't hide behind God's work, behind their good works, or their proven track record, simply because they don't have one. They can't even hide behind Moses. Moses offers to help down in verses 30 and 34. He says, the next day Moses said to the people, "You've committed a great sin, but now I will go to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Now, even Moses is uncertain. I know he offers himself in their place, but it doesn't work, does it? Verse 33, the Lord replied to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book." Is there any hope for sinners? Well, there is. And in these last few minutes, I just want to focus our minds back on Moses' first prayer. Back in verse 13, he prays, "Remember your servant Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, 'I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever.' Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened." Israel's hope isn't that God will change his mind, but that God will stick with it, that he'll stick to his promise that he'd made to Abraham. That promise was unconditional. In no ways did it depend upon Israel's obedience. God had sworn it by himself and offers Israel a single ray of hope within a very dark chapter. It keeps them in the game. It keeps them alive and kicking until a time when God would again take up this promise and complete it fully and finally by sending someone in Abraham's line to redeem Abraham's line, by sending someone who was greater than Moses, someone who could atone for their sin, by sending one who wouldn't bow down to the idols from his day, but would rescue them from those idols, by sending someone who would bear God's image truly to the world, rather than like a golden calf, someone who would rightly receive all of their worship, by sending someone who would suffer God's burning wrath and God's plague in their place instead of them, by sending someone who would restore in us the image of God and refashion us again in his likeness, by sending someone who would give us new hearts, no longer inclined towards sin, but inclined towards God, by sending Jesus. Let's pray together. One and only God, while we may not have bowed down to a golden calf or engaged in revelry, we confess that our hearts have been no different to theirs. In spite of your greater rescue and greater grace in our lives, we confess that we've given our thanks and praise and devotion and worship to lesser gods. We've turned from you, the fount of living water, and tried to drink from cisterns cracked and dry. We may have bowed down to the altar of money, or served the idol of security, indulged in the idol of comfort, sacrificed to the god of control, enthroned family as our god, or revered others more than we revere you. Lord, you know the idols that we've worshipped. You know the insults of our hearts even better than we do. You would be right to bring upon us the judgment that we deserve as sinful people. You don't delight in sacrifice, or we would bring it. You take no pleasure in burnt offerings. Our sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart you will not despise. You are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and it's to your character and to your Son that we appeal as we ask that in your mercy you would forgive us. Please would your Son appeal for us, just as Moses did for his people. Forgive us for breaking your greatest commandment to love you with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind, and save us from the slavery and service of idols. Please break the idols of our heart. And out of your great mercy, heal us and give us new and undivided hearts that desire to love and worship you alone. Create in us pure hearts, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within us. Restore to us the joy of your salvation and grant us willing spirits that enter into the freedom and joy of serving you. Amen. Well, hear these great words of assurance from Thessalonians for all those who have turned from idols. Paul says of the Thessalonians, "The Lord's message rang out from you, not only in Macedonia, but in Achaia. Your faith in God has become known everywhere. Therefore, we do not need to say anything more about it, for they themselves report what kind of reception you gave us. They tell how you turned to God from idols to serve the true and living God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath." Well, let's return to Jesus. Let's turn